All right, guys, before we jump in, I want to tell you real quick about the 0 to 100 Elite Mastermind. This is our own high-level group for serious real estate investors looking to scale fast. Inside, we share deals, strategies, and we build real relationships all to grow our cash flow portfolios. And you know what? Most members actually add 10-plus units in their first year. Plus, you'll get exclusive access to our podcast guests for direct Q&A. If you're chasing time freedom through real estate, check it out at 0to100tribe.com. That's Z-E-R-O-T-O, the number 100tribe.com. Now, enjoy the show.
We increase the value of that park $700,000 by sending one letter. That's called forced appreciation. That's called lazy appreciation. And it was very fair. It was an equitable transaction between us and the residents.
Being on some chill, we go 0 to 100 real quick.
Welcome to the 0 to 100 podcast. I'm Travis Dillard, and we're all about scaling a cash flow real estate portfolio from 0 to over 100 units and achieving your retirement number one, or R1. That's where passive income from real estate replaces your day job and gives you complete time freedom, which is the new currency of the rich.
I'm Mitchell England, and I'm thrilled to have you on board. With our combined real estate holdings valued over $100 million, learn from us and others who've achieved time freedom through cash flow real estate.
This is Gabriel Hamill. Here at 0 to 100, you will not hear us talk about house flipping, spec homes, wholesaling, or land banking. We are only about achieving time freedom through buying and holding cash flow real estate. So remember, if R1 is the destination, real estate is the vehicle, and cash flow is the gas. Now go out there and buy some cash flow real estate.
Hey everybody, this is Travis with the 0 to 100 All Hands Call and the 0 to 100 podcast. The 0 to 100 Tribe is all about achieving time freedom through cash flowing real estate. And we talk about how do we get to retirement number one, that's R1. How do we scale our real estate portfolio to where we can actually achieve location, time, and financial freedom? How do we have enough cash flow coming in to cover all of our living and lifestyle expenses so we can hang up the day job and then from there go play pickleball with Mitch for the rest of our life and or continue to scale our portfolio or do whatever you want? We're very picky in this tribe. We talk about things like very specific asset classes, which is actually what this call today is going to be about. What asset classes provide outsized cash flow returns but don't require a ton of time? You won't hear us talk a lot about wholesaling or flipping or development or land banking. We're all about how do we generate as much passive income as opposed to active income, meaning passive is like, how do we wake up at the beginning of every month, check our bank account and have a bunch of extra money in our account? How do we leverage other people's time, our residence and money? How do we leverage other people's money like investors? And how do we raise capital and use bank lending to buy assets that generate cash flow? And we have sort of a framework in the 0 to 100 tribe. The framework with 0 to 100 in our mind is like, get your mindset right. How can I buy properties not necessarily in my backyard? How do I buy in areas that maybe have higher cash flow fundamentals? So we like the Midwest. We like the Southeast. How do I get my mindset right around like, why not buy bigger properties? There's 1, 2, 3 unit properties, 4 unit properties, but 5 and over, I can actually force appreciate. Remember, for every annual dollar of net operating income I produce, I can increase the value of a property 10 to 20 times. So I can buy a commercial property, whether that's a residential apartment building, a mobile home park, self-storage, triple net industrial, in an area that's really not doing much. It's just sort of steady eddy. And I can force appreciate it millions and millions of dollars. We actually have a deal we're looking at in real time on the Elite Call. It's a mobile home park Mitch and I are looking at where we buy in like steady eddy Wisconsin, but because we can get rents up to market and create some net operating income efficiencies, we can literally double the value of the property in a couple of years. That's millions of dollars of wealth creation. A big part of that is like, how can I buy? Yes, I can buy out of state. Yes, I can buy bigger properties. I'm not afraid of larger commercial assets. And yes, I can potentially get really good at it. So maybe if I have nothing, I'll go from 0 to something. Maybe I buy a house hack, I buy a plex, I get some notoriety, I get some equity. From there, I do something a little bigger, maybe a small apartment complex, maybe a 5-unit property, learn, and then I pick my asset class. I think this is really important. I don't think we stress that enough. I equate like picking your asset class to get to R1 is like getting really damn good at a specific asset class. If you go talk to me, Mitch, Gabe, or other people that have achieved R1, they usually done it with like one asset class. It might be apartments. It might be like specific apartments in an area. Maybe it's a C-class, C+ apartments or B class apartments. Maybe it's like us, mobile home parks. But usually people pick a specific asset class, and we like specific asset classes that are less hands-on, less time intensive. So maybe it's like, again, self-storage, apartments, mobile home parks. We like RV parks. triple net industrial, things like that. And so then once you pick your asset class, you know, you have to get really damn good at it and you have to understand the nuances of it. You underwrite a mobile home park a hell of a lot different than you would a 200 unit class A apartment building in Dallas, or you underwrite triple net industrial a lot different than you would a mobile home park. And when you get really good at an asset class and you learn all you can about it, whether it's on this tribe or you read books, then you actually can start finding deals in deals. That means, okay, I'm looking at a deal across my desk. It looks like a six cap. Cash flow fundamentals aren't great. Debt's 8%. This doesn't look like a great deal. Oh, wait a minute. Because I'm really damn good at this asset class, these expense ratios look out of whack. These rents look out of whack. These occupancy numbers look out of whack. You can actually identify threats, which helps you like not step in a giant flaming pile of shit and get out of the deal. But more importantly, it also helps you find opportunities in those asset classes. I'm going to start with mobile home parks, pros and cons and nuances, take lots of notes. And then I'm going to talk about triple net industrial. I'm not as baked and familiar on triple net industrial, but I do have some triple net properties and there's things I do like about it. And there's some sort of high level sort of pros and cons and nuances about it. Again, ask questions as we go along. So let's talk about mobile home parks. Mobile home park, quick story about me. When I decided I wanted to really scale, Mitch and I decided that we really wanted to scale our portfolio. We'd spent like, I don't know, 10 to 15 years accumulating some apartment units, a couple single family houses. When I say apartment units, like, you know, duplex, threeplex. And we were sort of scattered, right? And we decided we really wanted to scale. We wanted to go larger properties and we wanted to go apartment buildings. And so, and we really wanted to look at the Midwest. And so I did what a lot of new investors did. We got on Crexie, we got on LoopNet. We just started looking at apartment building after apartment building. Actually got into contract on an apartment building and flew out to Milwaukee and ended up getting in contract. And thank God we didn't close that deal. In hindsight, that would have been a really bad way to start our scale investing career. And so we kept looking and we kept looking. And the more I kept seeing these mobile home parks crossing my desk. I didn't know anything about mobile home parks. I mean, I lived in a double wide as a kid and my grandparents lived in a mobile home park. Other than that, I knew nothing about it, but I kept looking at the cash flow fundamentals. And this was like back in 2017 or 18 when you could throw a rock and hit a mobile home park that was operating at a 10% capitalization rate. For those of you that don't know what a cap rate is or an operating cap rate, that's what is the net operating income divided by the purchase price. That's not including debt service. Net operating income is the profit, income minus expenses, not including debt service, divided by the purchase price. So it's how you compare the cash flow that the property spits off compared to its purchase price. And it was really, really high. By the way, if you're looking for mobile home parks these days, you're not going to find anything hardly ever that's operating at a 10 cap. Or if you do, it's bullshit, meaning there's deferred maintenance or it's very small. There's hair on, like major hair on the deal. There's challenges all over the place with it. But I kept looking at these mobile home parks and I was like, this is crazy. And I had a duplex that I was selling and I had about $200,000 in equity in this duplex. And I was making about $800 a month in positive cash flow. It held up for 10 years or 8 years at the time. And so we found a mobile home park in North Carolina. It was actually 20 pads of mobile home, long-term mobile home and 20 pads of RV, long-term RV. Still hold that park, by the way. It's in Bridgeton, North Carolina. And as a side note, I was able to take that $200,000 equity out of my duplex by selling it. I did a 1031 tax deferred exchange, which means I didn't pay any long-term capital gains on the proceeds. And I moved it and I used it as a down payment with Mitchell and we bought this mobile home park. We did what's called a TIC, a tenant in common, because there's some nuances behind that. If you're getting into 1031 exchanges, hit me up. I can tell you about that. What's cool about this park though, is, and I've talked about this on the show here before, is that I took $800 a month in positive cash flow and I turned it to about $2,400 to $3,000 a month in positive cash flow because I bought this thing at a 10 cap. And at the time, rates were in the 4%, 25-year AM. Like, we walked into 20% cash on cash. Back in the day, it's like, oh, if we can find something operating at a 10 cap and, you know, you're getting 4.5% interest rate with a 25-year AM debt and 25% down, which is pretty common, then you could actually achieve 20% cash on cash. Those days will come back someday, perhaps 2024. Perhaps you're going to find deals out there where you have distressed sellers and you can walk into really good deals like this. But what is a mobile home park? You can Google it. It's basically a large piece of land with mobile home pads or spaces on it. And the spaces are wired in for electrical. They're wired in for sewer. They're wired in for water, right? And you as the park owner generally are providing the infrastructure. You're providing the land. And generally speaking, people would move their homes into that mobile home park, and they would own the home themselves, the mobile home. And they call them mobile homes, but honestly, like, you know, a lot of these homes were moved in like the 60s or 70s or 80s or 90s. And they never moved, right? They were mobile because they were homes built in a factory and then moved onto this large piece of land. And the definition of a mobile home park is like a large piece of land with, I think, more than two or more contiguous pads or spaces, right? So the history of mobile home parks is really interesting because they actually used to be kind of swanky. They were interesting. They were new, like it was affordable housing, but like there were these communities, people can bring in these cool mobile homes. They were kind of trendy at the time, like maybe like bell bottoms or something like that. And like bell bottoms, by the way, mobile home parks are coming back. But people would, like park owners, a lot of times these parks were created by people that like owned, like they had a farm, they had a bunch of land, and they would just go out and build them. They'd wire in a mobile home park. They would build all these pads and these put roads in, and then they would contact a mobile home dealer, like someone that actually like a manufacturer, a dealer of mobile homes, and they would then go place homes on the lots, and they would invite customers in, and the customers would buy the home and pay the lot rent. And it was a great way for people to live. In fact, there's a lot of old Elvis movies where he like literally living in mobile home parks. But over the years, obviously, mobile home parks got a stigma. The homes deteriorated because of those early mobile homes wore down pretty quickly. The landlords weren't really great at, you know, keeping the bad tenants out and the good tenants in. And so then you eventually had drugs and crime, and that's where you got the term trailer trash and trailer parks, et cetera, et cetera. Quick question here from Ralph. Thanks, Ralph, for asking a question. People are listening. What's the difference between a mobile home and a manufactured home? Nothing. In fact, if you say I own trailer parks, I own mobile home parks or manufactured housing communities. In my mind, they're pretty much all the same. Someone might argue with me on that. But generally speaking, they were called mobile homes because they could be built and then shipped on a truck. But mostly like the manufactured homes these days are actually really nice. Like the mobile homes built in like the 60s and the 70s. They were generally like tin. They had crappy roofs. They fell apart. They leaked. They didn't last that long. But in a lot of cases, the newer manufactured homes of today, the double wides that you see, and even the nicer single wides, they're actually built the code, and they're actually sometimes built better than site-built stick homes. So great question. Mobile home, manufactured home, say the same. If you're like me and you want to sound cool at a cocktail party, say, oh, I've invested in manufactured housing communities. Well, I buy mobile home parks. Great question, though. So back to the history of mobile home parks, a lot of mom and pop owners. And another thing that would happen is the best way to own a mobile home park is you own all the land. So I'm responsible for the roads. I'm responsible for the utilities, the infrastructure. I'm responsible for maybe like a laundry facility or a mail room, that kind of stuff. But I am not responsible for the home. I don't own the home. And what does that mean? Or out of the gate, that means I'm not maintaining roofs, leaky faucets, HVAC units that are going out, etc. And so generally speaking, when you hear people talk about mobile home parks, you'll hear tenant-owned homes and park-owned homes, or TOH or POH. Tenant-owned homes are the ones you don't own. Those are the ones you don't. You don't want to own the home, in my mind. Park-owned homes or community-owned homes are the homes that you own. And over the time, what would happen is people would leave these homes and abandon them. And then the park owner, the mobile home park owner, would then take possession of those homes, get title to those homes. Their title's like, it's like a car. It's like a vehicle. It's personal property. And then they would fix it up, and then they would rent it out as a rental unit. And they could have sold it off, which they should have, but they now own it as a rental unit. You see some mobile home parks that are for sale in this country where they're like all park-owned homes. Well, what does that mean? House, single-family house, apartment building, stick-built, you're going to see an expense ratio, which is the percentage of the expenses, which is your expenses as a percentage of the revenue, you know, around 45 to 55%. Park-owned homes, because they weren't built as well, this is the earlier park-owned homes, oftentimes the maintenance is going to be more than the rent you're collecting on the home. So the holy grail of a mobile home park is don't own the homes, own the land, right? Because now your expense ratio is in like the 25 to 35%. We have a park and another park in North Carolina that actually is about a 20% expense ratio, which is great. Quick question from Lucas. What is the difference of a mobile home and an RV park? Great question. Mobile home is just that. It's a manufactured home where you bring a single wide or a double wide or triple wide in some cases in. It stays there forever. Usually it's like it's sitting on a foundation, or they take the wheels off it, they skirt it, they put porches on it, it's not going anywhere. An RV is a recreational vehicle. RV parks. There's different types of RV parks. For those of you that are an elite, by the way, we have a great asset class guide on RV parks and mobile home parks. RV park can be like what we have. We do own an RV park. It's sort of like and there's different types of RV parks. We have a destination RV park. We live in a destination area. People like to drive their RVs here, their Airstreams. They park it in this RV park. They pay us $60 to $100 a night. By the way, cash flows like crazy. And they come in there and they're at a destination area. There's also like roadside RV parks where you're on your way somewhere, you know, you stop at the KOA. It's a nightly stay. Now there's becoming, unfortunately, with sort of the demise of the middle class and unfortunately the criticality of affordable housing, you're starting to see a lot of mobile home park or a lot of RV parks are bringing in long-term RVers. So it's like a mobile home park. They bring an RV in. The person sometimes skirts it and puts the porches on and they sit it there forever. Or maybe they don't, but RVs are a lot more mobile. If you have a tenant that decides they don't want to pay, they can just leave in the middle of the night. Mobile home parks, they can't. They can't just pick up their double wide or their single wide that's been there for the last 20 years and move it. Or if they do, it's going to be really costly. So RV stands for recreational vehicle. MHP stands for mobile home park. So let's talk about the pros of mobile home parks. I've already talked a little bit about this. By the way, keep the questions coming in. I love this. Okay, number one, one of the pros for mobile home parks, especially when you have tenant-owned homes, the tenants are sticky. They generally don't leave, right? An average tenant in a mobile home park, they own the home. They're going to be there potentially 20 years or longer. And we say that all the time. Well, why? Well, number one, they might be paying like $250, $300, $400 a month in lot rent. Well, that's pretty inexpensive compared to an apartment. They're not going to leave in the middle of the night to go to an apartment where they're going to be paying $1,200 a month or $900 a month for that apartment, right? And with a mobile home, they get a two-bedroom, three-bedroom, two-bath, one-bath home. They get a yard. They get a playground. You know, they get amenities. Like, they actually live in a neighborhood, which is another pro. Like, I think mobile home parks are kind of like the last great frontier of affordable housing. People actually get, if you're a good operator and you're a good landlord like we are, and we put playgrounds in and laundry facilities, you can make it an actual neighborhood. It's a community. It's not a box in a box like an apartment building. So tenants are stickier, right? Like, if you raise rents, they're usually not going to spend the $5,000 to $6,000 to $7,000 to $8,000 or whatever to move their home out of that park. They're just going to pay the extra rent because the economics don't make any sense, right? And they like it. If you take good care of them, they're going to stay there forever. Let's see. We got another question in here. Can you sell a POH to a tenant? Absolutely. We do it all the time. A lot of times we'll buy parks because usually when you're buying parks, you get park-owned homes in there and you have to do something with that park-owned home. We'll usually sell it to a tenant or somebody outside the park. We'll offer it to the tenant first if they qualify, and then if they don't, we'll sell it to someone else. And someone will either come in and pay cash for it and then pay you pad rent. Most of the time, though, they'll buy it on a contract. We'll go in, we'll fix it up, we'll rehab it, and then we'll say, okay, we're going to sell you this home for $15,000, put $2,000 to $3,000 down, and then we'll carry a contract. So you're paying your pad rent, that doesn't change, but then you pay the home off, and then you own the home. It's actually a really cool way of homeownership for people that don't make a lot of money. They can actually own their home. And then what's cool about that is because they're paying it off on a contract. Some people call it an RTO or a rent to own. Some people, I own several contracts where I'm selling homes to tenants. The maintenance is off your books, right? Because remember, the maintenance on some of these mobile homes are really expensive, right? And so if you're charging someone $600 a month, $300 is for pad rent and the other $300 is for the home, heck, you can have one HVAC system go out and you're underwater on that home. So it's great to sell to tenants and getting the maintenance off your books. What happens if they default? Another great question. Well, then they default and then you take the home back and you fix it up and you sell it again. Happens all the time. So, and a lot of times they don't want to default. And if you're a good operator and you run background checks, you run criminal checks, you run credit checks, you make sure that these people have the income so they can afford to pay the pad rent in the home. But again, it's good for us, but it's really great for people that want a community. They want a neighborhood. They want, you know, affordable housing with dignity, especially if you're a good operator. Don't be a slumlord. You know, we always reinvest back in our communities. Like I said, we're adding amenities. We've added community gardens. We've added playgrounds for the kids. We've added dog parks. There's so many cool things you can do with a mobile home park to add value for your tenants, and also gives you a reason to go raise rents and start bringing rents closer to market. Other pros of mobile home parks. There's a reducing supply, right? I think there's like 40,000 mobile home parks in the country right now. Really popular in the United States. Although I thought they were only in the United States, and I was actually on a World War II trip in Normandy and like literally Omaha Beach where D-Day happened. And I looked up on the crest and I saw a mobile home park in France, which was the craziest thing. I don't know if it was a mobile home park or what, but it was multiple mobile homes sitting up on the top of a cliff. So I thought that was pretty cool. But the point I was going to make is there's a reducing supply of mobile home parks out there. It's usually doesn't pencil to build a new mobile home park. There's a few reasons. One, built buying the land, running all the utilities, getting the entitlements, even getting a city or a county to approve a mobile home park is really, really challenging because a lot of people have that not in my backyard mentality, meaning like, I love this. We need affordable housing. Okay, let's build a brand new, beautiful mobile home park where people have affordable housing. They're like, not in my backyard. So a lot of mobile home parks that are out there are actually grandfathered in. They're like this weird, they were built like in the 70s and they're grandfathered in and they'll continue to operate as a mobile home park. But building new mobile home parks is tricky and it's not cost effective. It costs a lot of money. And so a lot of times, if you can buy an in-place cash flowing mobile home park, it's a reducing supply and there's increasing demand for these assets. And so what does that do? Whenever there's an increasing demand and a reducing supply, that means the prices get driven up. And so because of that, you can do really well with mobile home parks. Also, a lot of these mobile home parks were owned by mom and pop owners, still are. And the consolidation is starting to happen. What does consolidation mean? Consolidation is like, this happened in self-storage. A lot of self-storage facilities were owned by individual operators and then mom and pop operators, I should say. And then large big box stores or big retail outfits or big brands came in and brought all of these self-storage. Well, what happens in large, like private equity back or publicly traded companies go in and buy up all the assets in an area? What drives the prices up? They go in, they immediately raise rents. Well, when rents go up, the values go up. So if you own, by the way, if you were one of those self-storage operators that owned a couple self-storage facilities in like Phoenix and then a large publicly traded company, an REIT, a REIT, or a private equity backed company comes in and buys up all the self-storage, you're going to make a lot of money. Mobile home parks, it's starting to happen. We're starting to see, you know, Sam Zell was the largest mobile home park owner in the country. He's dead now, but Sam Zell, you're seeing some large players come in and starting to buy these up, but it's still not, it hasn't been consolidated yet, which is an opportunity for you if you wanted to buy mobile home parks. And also, a lot of these mom and pop owners became really good friends with the residents. A lot of times they had a house that was right by the park. That's really popular in the Midwest. And these people came in, or these mom and pop landlords kept rents artificially low. Like, they own the land already. It's already paid off. They're charging $200 a month in pad rent. It's plenty of money for them to live. But market rents on these things are usually like $450, right? And so a lot of times there's this artificially subdued lot rents across the country. And as an operator, if you can come in and find those well below market rents and start bringing those closer to market, there's an amazing amount of money to be made doing that, right? Remember, for every annual dollar of profit you create in an asset, you're increasing the value of the property 10 to 20 times. So you're going in, you're buying these parks with under market lot rents, you're bringing up the market, and you're starting to get cap rate compression. For those of you that don't know what cap rates, trading cap rates, operating cap rates, become an elite member, take our accelerator course, learn about this stuff. But basically, cap rate compression is for every annual dollar that I said in net operating income that you add, you get 10 to 20 times the value increase. Well, the lower the trading cap rate, the more the multiple you're getting on that property. So there's going to be more valuation. So reducing supply, hasn't been consolidated yet. A lot of mom and pop owners out there that have kept pad rents lower. Okay, we have some questions here. How do you get rid of a mobile home if it is not worth rebuilding? You scrap it. You tear it down. So, and a lot of times when we go in to buy a mobile home park, we'll look at all the park-owned homes, or maybe a lot of times we'll find a lot of vacant homes. We went into a park that had like, I think, 20 vacant park-owned homes that had been abandoned, really crappy operator. And we went in and looked at these homes and 10 could be salvaged. So we just scrapped the other 10, and then we rehabbed the 10 that were salvageable, and we sold them off on a rent-to-own contract. So yeah, a lot of times you can't pull these things out of the parks if they're really old and falling down. If banks didn't lend on them, how did they sell? Well, banks actually used to lend on mobile homes. There were some lending. There's still some lending. There's some legislation that really wants to allow Fannie and Freddie to start lending on mobile homes. But there are also some other lenders like 21st Mortgage and some others that actually do specialized mobile home lending. So yeah, banks used to lend. And that was a big problem when Fannie and Freddie stopped lending on these mobile homes. That's where a lot of these parks had problems. But there are definitely some lending programs that are coming back around for the right newer mobile homes. But that's why generally, if you have an older mobile home where you can't get financing on, you become the bank. You take the home over, you rehab it, and you sell it on a rent-to-own contract. Where do you recommend looking for mobile home parks state-wise? Red states. You just answered your own question. Yeah. I don't like to buy residential properties in blue states. I don't like the government advertising to my tenants that they don't have to pay rent, or I don't like it taking 2 years to get someone to stop paying rent and set up a meth lab in one of my properties. I like properties where I can enforce rules and I can enforce rent collection. So that is one con of mobile home parks. Like if I wanted to really scale in apartment buildings, I could go pick an area. I can go pick, I'm going to be an Oklahoma City investor, or I'm going to be a Dallas Fort Worth area, and I'm going to go buy B class in this particular neighborhood because there's so much more supply of apartment buildings. Mobile home parks, like I said, they're reducing in supply. So when we look for mobile home parks, we kind of have to go where we find the deal. Number one, red states. Number two, stable or growing population. Number three, employment diversification. Number four, like who's employing my tenants, right? Is there Walmart close by? Is there big box stores that are going to employ my tenants? Right. These big box stores are the ones doing all the demographic studies. So just find out where they're going and go buy properties in those red states. But red states are going to give you a lot more flexibility. But like we own mobile home parks in Florida, the Carolinas, Pennsylvania. We're looking at stuff in the Midwest. Like if it's a red state and it's in a decent population, we're interested. And if the fundamentals look right. Another question, FHA financing on manufactured homes require permanent foundation and land ownership. Does this not apply? I don't really know. This has been changing, FHA financing on manufactured homes. I don't know. I think that there is some financing coming back for people that don't own the land, where they just want to finance a newer home. Now, is it Fannie Freddie or is it FHA? I don't know yet. So do your own research. But this has been legislation that's been a bit of a moving target. All right. So let's talk about additional benefits of mobile home parks. I talked about reducing supply, increasing demand. I talked about lower expense ratios. By the way, on that sort of park-owned home, tenant-owned home stuff, if you really want to get into mobile home park investing, man, understand how to underwrite these things because you can get beat up quickly. You can overpay. Here's an example. Let's say you buy a park with it's a 50-pad park and half the homes are park-owned homes. A lot of sellers and a lot of brokers will count all of the income on those park-owned home rentals. So let's say you got half the park, they're paying $300 a month in pad rent. The other half the park, they're paying $700 to $800 to rent the home. A lot of times those people will take all that income and they'll capitalize that into the value. Oh, I'm not going to get into like net operating income divided by trading cap rates equals value, but know that they factor that into the profit of the property. And a bank looks at it, an appraiser looks at it, any savvy mobile home park investor, you cannot count the revenue associated with the home into the value of the park. Now, the same goes for the expenses too, though. So like when we're underwriting a park and we're looking at the income and expenses, we'll separate out the income and the expenses for the dirt itself, or we call it the park operations, and we'll separate that from the income and expenses associated with the park-owned homes. Because yeah, the cash flow is there. It does factor into cash flow. It does factor into debt hurdles. It does factor into cash on cash, but it cannot factor into the valuation. Sometimes you can assign like a light shell value, like every home gets a $5,000 value. Like you'll see sellers doing that. But I've seen a lot of new mobile home park investors. And I was the same way. I got really excited about the income associated with the park-owned home. Again, a lot of that income on the park-owned home, you pretty much wash out with expenses. So when we're underwriting park-owned home, unless it's a newer home, will I say, okay, that $800, $300 goes to pad rent. We can capitalize that. We'll assign like a 35% expense ratio to that. But the rest, the other $400 to $500 that are associated with the park-owned home, we just wash that out with expenses because these park-owned homes will cripple you on expenses if you don't underwrite it correctly. So I'm kind of jumping back and forth between pros and cons. The other thing, I always say this a lot, like mobile home parks, man, like people like to buy land. They like to bank land, right? But when you buy a piece of land, are you cash flowing that piece of land? No. You're cash flowing negative. You're paying taxes on it. You're paying insurance on it. It's not generating any income, but there's a lot of people that like to land bank. They like to buy land and sit on it, right? It's speculative. Well, why not buy a piece of land that's cash flowing like crazy, right? So we have large swaths of land, acres and acres, hundreds and hundreds of acres of land that's cash flowing. And say down the road, 20 years, 30 years down the road, 15, I don't know, maybe that eventually gets redeveloped. Maybe it's in the path of progress and they want to build a strip mall there or you know, apartment buildings or, you know, triple net industrial. Like, but you're buying large chunks of land, like acres and acres of land. So sometimes I think people forget about that. I talked about under market rents. And by the way, if you kind of want to know what the market rent is for a pad in a particular market, obviously call other mobile home parks, you know, secret shop them, ask them what they're charging pad rent, what utilities are included or utilities not included, And also, if you can't really get triangulate on that, take the average cost of a two or the average rent of a two bedroom apartment and take 50% of that. That's usually what we'll do. If we'll just quickly go to like bestplaces.net, look at what the average two bedroom apartment rent is. It's $800 a month or $1,000 a month. Okay. We think that market rents for a mobile home pad, not the Parco Nome, just the pad rent, could be about 50% of that. It's not always accurate. The Midwest is a little wonky sometimes, but generally speaking, that's a good sort of rule of thumb. And again, a lot of times you'll go, wait a minute, market rent here is like $400 and this guy's charging like $250. That spells opportunity, right? Not that you want to go in and just jack rents up immediately and hurt these people, but over time you can start bringing rents closer to market. And that's where a ton of, if you keep your expenses relatively in line, that's where a ton of value can be created. Okay. I think I talked about, I mean, obviously the more units you buy, the more pads you have, you're going to spread your risk across multiple pads, right? If I buy a 50 pad park, if I lose two or three or four or five of those to renters, I'm not like not making my expenses and my debt service, right? I'm spreading. That's why we like lots of units in 0 to 100. We like big apartment buildings, bigger mobile home parks, a lot of units with self storage because you're spreading your risk out across tenants. If I buy a duplex, I lose one of my tenants. I'm now 50% occupied. I'm underwater. I'm in the red on that and I'm feeding that property. So it's another thing I like about mobile home parks. One of the cons is the park owned home situation. If you don't really understand that and understand what you're getting into with park owned homes, you could overpay for a park. You can be way too rosy on your underwriting and not assign enough expenses to the park owned homes. And soon one hot water heater goes out, one HVAC goes out, all of your profit on that park owned home gets wiped out. Do not be tempted by the cash flow and the revenue on park-owned homes. There's some people that's their whole model is park-owned homes. They love it. Well, that's because they might go buy, you know, they might have several thousand pads in a particular location and they have a full-time maintenance crew on staff. It's a whole operation. Us, we own mobile home parks all over the country. We don't have maintenance crews. We are not vertically integrated like that. So we only want to own the dirt. By the way, with mobile home parks, utilities is really, 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 really important. Utilities, what does that mean? Okay, well, water, is it city water or is it well? Sewer, is it city sewer or is it septic systems? We have both, by the way. We generally don't like to buy a park with well and septic. We like one or the other to be city. And electric, obviously electric's pretty self-explanatory, but also how's the billing happening? A lot of electric, the tenants pay electricity directly to the municipality or the power company. They've got it metered directly to their house. You're out of the loop on that. That's the best way. Maybe you have a few street lights and some laundry machines that you're paying electricity for. That's really cool. Water, sometimes it's direct billed to the tenants. Sometimes it's direct billed to you as a master. And then you, and we buy parks like this with this, the owners paying for all of the utilities or paying for all the sewer and the water. And you go in and you can submeter it. You can put like Metron meters on the individual pads. And so you get the master bill and you bill back your tenants the water. It's a really great lazy reposition. Remember in 0 to 100 lazy reposition, what are nice, easy, light ways for us to increase net operating income without spending a bunch of time and money. Same with sewer. Like we bought a park that was 51 pads. Pad rents were $200 under market. And we had owner carried a contract. Another pro, by the way, is a lot of these mom and pops, most mobile home parks transacted with owner contracts early on. And a lot of these old timers didn't realize that there's banks that'll finance these things, especially now with the rates really high. Owner financing with mobile home parks is a lot more common. Sorry, I digressed a little bit, but that's another big con is owner financing, by the way, is awesome. If Gabe was on here, he'd be saying, hell yeah. Owner financing is great, especially right now. So back to the utilities, we bought this 51 pad park. It had a well, but it's a really good well. We ran a ton of diligence on it. We did bacteria testing, flow testing. It was like the best well in the area. And it had city water. All we did is we just did a flat bill back to all the residents at $70 a pad. Well, they were already new. They were paying $200 under market rent in the area. We literally sent a letter, charged $70 to every tenant. They were fine. They got it. They totally understood. People pay for their own utilities. And I won't get into the math too much, but $70 times 51 pads times 12 months, we increased the value of that park $700,000 by sending one letter. That's called forced appreciation. That's called lazy appreciation. And it was very fair. It was an equitable transaction between us and the residents. People should be paying for their own utilities. Now, I like actually metering utilities even better than flat rate. Flat rate, or if you include it in people's rent, they are not going to conserve their utilities. They're going to keep their air conditioning or their heater on all day long. They're going to run their showers forever. Right. But as soon as you meter it and you charge them for electricity or sewer or water, whatever the case is, they're going to conserve utilities, right? That's just human nature. Generally speaking, as soon as you meter a utility and bill it back to somebody, they will reduce their usage by 30%. I've heard that. I don't know if that's scientifically proven, but I've heard that stat quite a bit. So utilities are really important, by the way. Like, there's also some mobile home parks you'll get and you're like, oh my gosh, these numbers are incredible. These look great. Well, what's the sewer? Oh, it's a wastewater treatment plant. Huh? Oh, what? A wastewater. Wait, what? They'll say wastewater treatment plant, WWTP. Don't buy wastewater treatment plants or really do your diligence, because that's like owning your own like sewage facility. And if, no pun intended, if shit goes wrong, you're in deep shit, right? It could be hundreds of thousands of dollars in repair. It could be environmental issues. By the way, anytime you buy a mobile home park, do a phase one environmental. Understand if there's potential contaminants. Phase one environmental is always really critical. RV parks, mobile home parks, because it's a form of insurance. If you got a phase one environmental and it came back clean and down the road there was an issue, your phase one, you can say, I got a phase one. I did my job, right? So if you don't know what that is, go Google it. Some other cons, and I'm not even gotten into triple net investing. So triple net industrial, I got to move quickly here. Let's see. Some of the cons: banks traditionally weren't as comfortable financing mobile home parks because there was stigma attached to it. But some of the banks are now catching on. They realize, especially on like agency debt, it has the lowest default rate of any asset class. Why? Because people own their homes. They're not moving. They're going to pay their rent. They don't want to get evicted, right? Let's see, some other cons. It's becoming way, way, way more popular. In 2018 is when Mitch and I started getting into it. And then Brandon Turner, our buddy Brandon Turner, got into mobile home park investing. He has a bigger platform than us, and he started telling everybody about it. Everybody got really interested in mobile home park investing because they're awesome, but there's a lot more competition out there. Infill is costly. Let's say you buy a 50-pad mobile home park that has 40 pads that are occupied. A lot of times brokers and sellers say, oh, that's fine. Just bring in 10 more homes, sell them off. It's easy. It's not freaking easy to bring homes in. If you're buying like a 3-star park where the homes are a little older, you're not going to pay $80,000, $50,000 for a brand new home and put it in. The economics don't make sense, right? If you have a brand new park with all brand new homes, yes, you can bring in new homes. You can sell them off to the residents. They can get financing on their own. Like, that works. But most of the time when you're operating in that sort of 3-star park area, which is more of affordable housing play, it's really difficult to bring homes. It costs too much money to bring a home in. Okay, so what's the next step? You buy a used home and you bring it in, which we've done a lot of this, and you rehab it and you sell it. That's a win. By the way, finding used mobile homes that are in decent condition that you can rehab are also really hard and costly. So infill is difficult with mobile home parks. So when we buy a mobile home park, we'll underwrite it just on the in-place fundamentals, the pads that are occupied. We give really no credit to the vacant pads. Sellers and brokers want you to give credit to the vacant pads, but I highly suggest you don't. But if you can find some vacant homes and you can bring some homes in, that's just like icing on the cake. Stigma, like we all, you know, trailer trash, mobile home parks have a stigma. I don't give a shit about that. I think you get out the bad eggs, you fix it up, you pave roads, you clean it up. When we buy a park, we immediately go in. We find out what's nasty. We bring in large dumpsters. We have community spring day. People clean up all the junk in their yards. We help people skirt their homes sometimes, power wash their homes, paint their homes. Sometimes we pave roads, we put speed bumps and park benches in, playgrounds, lights. Like, you can do some cool stuff to a mobile home park. Get out all the shitheads. And yes, Lucas, can you evict? Hell yeah, you can evict. People don't pay their pad rent, but they own the home, you evict them. A lot of times they'll just leave and then you have the home and then you can rehab it and sell it to a better tenant. So there's some stigma attached to mobile home parks. Financing can be a bit challenging, although I think that's getting less. Financing is just challenging, just period right now. It's just a pain in the ass with where the rates are. It's hard to make deals work, which, by the way, is why you do owner contracts. Let's see, anything else on mobile home parks? I love it. We own a lot of them. Most of our, I say 90% of our portfolio is mobile home parks. We just made an offer on a 250 pad park, like an $11 million portfolio. I will buy as many mobile home parks as I can, because mobile home parks, think of this. If pad rents are like, the average pad rents like $325, at least it was that way a couple of years ago. If average pad rents are like $325 a pad across the country, you're not going to tell me that. And then some places, like our park in Florida, it's like $650. We bought that park. Pad rents were in the $400 to $500 that the seller had it at. We have those over $500 now, and new people that are moving in are $650. We've made millions and millions and millions of upside on that park. So realistically, you can just go buy a bunch of parks that are at $300 pad rent, raise rents 5 to 10% a year. You're not telling me that like in 10 years, the pad rents are going to be at least double, probably triple or quadruple what they are now with inflation, with the government printing money and with rents going up. Like, absolutely. That means you can just buy these parks and just sit on them, and they're all going to be worth 2 to 4 times more than they are today. And they're large swaths of cash flowing land. Maybe you redevelop them down the road, but I think they're a fantastic investment. Obviously, I'm biased because we own mostly mobile home parks. I guess the last thing is, and I hit on this a little bit, like, I think they're the best affordable housing play out there, right? Okay, I'm a lower income person, maybe on fixed income. I have a choice. I can go live in a mobile home park, maybe, and I can get a home. Maybe I buy a home on contract, but it's home ownership. I own the home. It's my home, right? And then I'm paying a $300 pad rent, $350, $400 pad rent, right? Whereas I could go live in a 2-bedroom apartment or a single bedroom apartment, and I'm going to pay over $1,000 a month, right? And I'm a box in a box. I don't have a yard. I don't have the amenities that a mobile home park has. I don't have the privacy. I don't have the space. I'm not living in a community. It's an apartment building, right? And your average apartment building is, as a landlord, your turnover is like every 18 months. Mobile home parks, it could be 20 years. Triple net industrial, I'll talk a little bit about that. And we can dive into that more in future calls when we bring Gabe in, because Gabe has bought a lot of mobile home parks and he's really moved his targets to triple net industrial. And triple net industrial, triple net alone, and in the comments section, tell me if you know what a triple net lease is. Yes, no. Triple net is pretty cool. Like, I own a, it's not an industrial building, but I do own a building. It's retail and it's office. Triple net, NNN. That's basically where the tenant pays a base rent and they're responsible for pretty much all the expenses. They're responsible for taxes. They're responsible for insurance. They're responsible for a lot of the maintenance. Sometimes it's spelled out differently in the lease. Like, maybe you're responsible for like the foundation, the walls and the roof, right? And maybe like the core systems, like the HVAC and stuff like that. Sometimes not. Sometimes you're not responsible for any of that. All of the maintenance, all of that's on the tenant. Most of the time they're commercial tenants, right? They're an office or they're a company. They're a manufacturer. If you're industrial space, what's cool about that is you're not really responsible for the expenses, especially like in a high inflationary environment where like insurance is going up and taxes are going up. You can pass it on to your tenant. This particular building that I own is an old building. It's a super cool building, but it's old and it's in my hometown. I live in the Northwest and I wanted to put earthquake insurance on it because if this thing, because most insurance, by the way, doesn't include earthquake insurance. You have to specifically get earthquake insurance. And this thing was built in 1906. Like, it's brick. If there's an earthquake, it's a pile of bricks. So, and there it goes. And I won't be able to, if I go to my insurance company, they're going to say, sorry, it was an earthquake. Well, I live in the Northwest, so I put earthquake insurance on it. That's expensive. It was $17,000 a year. I pass it on to my tenants. Actually, I pass half of that on to my tenants because I wanted to take it easy on them. But with a triple, they're all triple net tenants. They're responsible for paying maintenance and their spaces are responsible for paying. Taxes go up, pass it on to the tenants. Insurance goes up, pass it on to the tenants. So with this isn't a built in 1906, my expense ratio on this building is like 46% or 45%. So it's pretty good. So you can really manage your expenses with triple net. A lot of times with triple net, another pro is that you get really long leases, especially like industrial. Like, and Gabe, again, he'd be talking all about this, but like you might buy an industrial, you might have 3 tenants or 2 tenants or 1 tenant. A lot of times they're signing like 10, 15, 20 year leases with a rent escalator every year. And so they're in there forever. Right. And the management's really low. They're companies. They generally just pay the rent. You're not managing evictions. You're not managing collections. They're owned by, if you underwrite it right, and you have good tenants, it's like the most passive investment you can do. You don't do shit. You basically collect a rent check. Now, that's with the right tenant, right? That's not a blanket comment. Like, you can buy a property with crappy tenants that stop paying you. So, by the way, this goes into the cons when you're buying triple net or industrial triple net. You need to underwrite the building. Equally, you need to underwrite the tenants. Like, who are they? Oh, they're a billion-dollar company. They have strong balance sheet. They sign 10-year leases. They're strong. They're a Starbucks. But sometimes that, like, people bought a lot of triple net stuff with like dollar stores and stuff in them. Sometimes large, like, national tenants, sometimes they can be like, yeah, I'm just not going to pay rent. I'm going to break my lease. You're like, you can't do that. And they're like, well, what are you going to do? I'm Starbucks, F you. Go hire attorneys. We've got like 100 attorneys in the back room. So sometimes when you give too much power to your tenant, that's a con of triple net. I think you have large, powerful tenants and you buy like these triple net industrial leases or these large triple net, like strip malls or whatever they call Starbucks, things like that. Sometimes your tenants can jerk you around because they have deeper pockets than you and they have resources. So I kind of jumped in. So like, I talked about financing as a pro, some of these, like a lot of times banks love these, especially if the tenants are like long-term tenants, they're well-known tenants, they have good balance sheets and they're signed. There's like, they have 8 years left on their lease. Banks really like that. Like it's sometimes a lot easier to get financing on some of the stuff. Gabe has just kicked some ass on some of his triple net industrial stuff. The banks have come in and give like rent credit, low cash down. He's gotten to some, he's in a deal right now, a triple net industrial space in the Midwest where he's at like 62% cash on cash, by the way Gabe structured the financing. So financing could be a lot easier on this stuff. Not really a con, but just like, again, an FYI is you have to underwrite your tenants, understand their financials. How long's the lease? Is there a rent escalator every year? What industry are they in? Right? Like, yeah, maybe they're a great big tenant, but they're in a shitty industry that's getting disrupted, right? That's why I like industrial or distribution facilities. Like buy triple net buildings where like there's tenants that are in a winning industry, right? Like buying all the buildings that like Kmart occupied. Maybe that's not a great idea because like brick and mortar, low cost brick and mortar stuff was kind of going to hell and those things were moving online. But like distribution facilities, my mom's boyfriend invests as an LP in these distribution facilities all across the country. Well, that's red hot right now. They can't build them fast enough because of all of the e-commerce stuff that's been happening over the last decade. On again, like, man, you own a giant in triple net industrial space and you've got a resident in there, a long-term person in there, and they've been in there for 20 years and they decide to move out and they don't renew their lease. You could be owning like several, hundreds of thousands of square foot of space that's sitting vacant for years. Like, because, or it's really costly to bring in a new tenant because you have to have the right tenant, someone that wants that space. Maybe it's a manufacturing company, right? And a lot of times the tenant improvements or TI that they do or you do, or the request of you could be hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. So like, depending on, like, if you just have one big triple net industrial space and maybe you have one tenant and you lose that tenant, you're in trouble. You're in trouble for a long time. Now, Gabe's philosophy, he agrees with that. But he's also saying, you know what, I'm going to go buy as many of these as I can. So if I have like my one big tenant in the north and the Midwest go vacant, I've got all these other triple net high cash flowing assets. So sort of cover that and help me build out the TI. And it could take years. I've seen places sit vacant for years. So that's risky, right? If you have like, again, mobile home park, like 50 unit apartment building, 100 unit mobile home park, you lose 10 of the tenants, 5 of the tenants, you're fine, right? It's a lot less risky. With these though, you have so much tenant and revenue concentration, it can be scary. So that is definitely a risk, and it could take a lot of time to lease these things up. Large national tenants, again, I mentioned this before, like they could be like, yeah, I'm Starbucks, I'm going to break my lease, we're closing all of our Seattle stores. You're like, but wait a minute, you're Starbucks, you're not supposed to cancel your lease. Yeah, we're going to. And yeah, what are you going to sue us? We're Starbucks. So I always like, my brother-in-law worked for FedEx, or ways that he owned his own company where he's a driver for FedEx, had 10 employees, had trucks. I'm like, I used to be like, bro, man, you have like one customer. That one customer decides to tell you to go to hell. Like, you're screwed. Sure enough, that happened. He got in deep shit with this particular, because FedEx decided to change the game. And if you have like all of your revenue attached to one large national, deep pocketed, high resource tenant, that can be really risky too. Questions. How do you go about finding triple net buildings on LoopNet? Well, I mean, it's just like any asset. You can go on LoopNet or Crexie and you can go find all the deals that die or overpriced. Gabe's done really well. He actually, again, it goes back to relationships. He bought a large triple net building and he partnered with a broker that really, that's all they do, is they specialize in large triple net industrial spaces. And they like Gabe. Gabe likes them. So they're bringing him deals. But also the bank, that particular broker or brokerage company also had lending. They had a bank that loved these large triple net industrial stuff. And so Gabe went to the bank and said, hey, I've got a relationship with you. Where do you want to finance assets? They said, well, we like these type of assets or these type of tenants and these locations. And Gabe said, okay, broker, go find me these deals because I've got a lender lined up right here. So again, it's like any real estate. Relationships with off-market stuff. Most of the stuff's more sort of professionally owned and managed. So banks, brokers that specialize in this asset class. And also just like, I say this all the time, like you can find a deal and or you can make a deal, right? Sometimes like Gabe, if he got a shitty finance package on that deal that he bought, maybe it wasn't a great deal, but he was able to put very little cash. I think he was like in at 10% or less 62% cash on cash. Like, you can make a deal, by the way, guys. And don't forget that with education and mindset, you know how to find, and that's why we like to focus in on like pick an asset class to get to R1 and become really damn good at the asset class. Because if you do that, you can see opportunities. You can go, ah, I'm a mobile home park investor. I'm looking at a property. It's 60% expense ratio. Something's wrong. That's either an opportunity or a threat. It's being mismanaged. The manager's robbing them. And there's maybe the utility. I look at the water. I'm like, what's going on with the water? Water's really high. I know I can go fix some pipes, fire a property manager, fix collections, and I just made $1 million. Like, so deals can be found and deals can be made. So remember that. And there's all kinds of levers with deals. There's how do you structure the debt, interest rate, amortization? Is it interest only period? Is it seller financing? Is it low cash in? Is it no cash in? You know, there's so much creative with commercial real estate. It's not like buying a house where it's like, I buy it and that's the price. And this is my 30-year mortgage. And that's what I get with commercial real estate, triple net, industrial, mobile home parks, seller financing. There's so many, if you're really educated, there's so many different levers that you can pull around like, okay, well, I want to buy this on seller contract, but the rents are really low. So my cash flow is crap, but I know that the market rents are here. Okay. We were talking about this on the Elite Call. Well, why don't I just work an owner contract and have him carry an interest-only note at 3% for 3 years and then start amortizing it at 4.5%. Okay, well, that gives me 3 years of runway to raise my rents, to reduce my expenses, to put my value-add plans in place, force appreciate the asset. We call that lazy reposition. I'm not talking building new pads, building new wings on apartment buildings, building hotels, developing bare land. I'm talking about buying in-place cash flow streams, in-place assets, whether it's mobile home park, self-storage, or triple net industrial. And I'm saying, okay, how can I input the least amount of time and get the maximum amount of return? I know I can raise rents to market over time. I know I can take out expenses. Maybe I can pass utilities to my residents. Maybe I can put vending machines and laundry machines in. Maybe I can put storage facilities in my mobile home park. Maybe I can, we've bought parks that had two managers, an onsite and an offsite, and they were getting just destroyed with their management fees. We fired the offsite manager. The onsite guy was great. Collections went up. He was happier. He made a little extra money. As a park we bought for 1.5, it's now worth 3.2. And that was 2 years ago. So this game is real and it can happen. All right. I love the questions. Thank you so much, because it doesn't feel like I'm talking to myself. I hope this was helpful. Appreciate your support. I almost canceled the day because my co-hosts were gone, but hopefully this was valuable. Get involved with the tribe. This is a community. This is for you guys to learn from each other, learn from us. And we're super thankful for all of you. And remember, go do something. Go from zero to something. Pick an asset class, learn all you can about it, learn how to raise capital, learn how to find value. This isn't rocket science, and it's obviously my favorite subject. It excites the hell out of me. So thanks, everybody. Have a great, great week. Go write some LOIs, go find some deals, get on the tribe, ask questions, invite your friends to the tribe. Let's grow this thing. I'm done. Thanks, everybody.